Voice of Reason Broadcast Network presents The Heretics Hour with Carolyn Yeager. Carolyn Yeager brings you news and commentary on Holocaust revisionism, World War II history, free speech issues, and more. And now, here's Carolyn.
Good evening, ladies and gentlemen. I am Carolyn Yeager, coming to you live with the Heretics Hour this Monday, August 29th. 29 is a number that I consider to be, I don't know what I'd consider it, high activity or something. I was actually born on the 29th of a month. I won't say which one. And it is... It seems like lots of things happen on the 29th. Today, my day has been really kind of maddening with lots of people, lots of things coming up, and lots of messages. And some of it has to do with my my other program, which was canceled. And some of it, though, is like I can't figure out yet if it is people who are pulling the wool over my eyes or if there's just some problem with communication. But there's a lot of strange things going on today. I hope it won't affect our program tonight because my guest is Mr. Frederick Tobin. But before I bring him on to say hello and talk to us, I want to thank those of you who sent money to Carlo Matonio's PayPal account and those of you who haven't yet done so but are going to do so. I know more of you are going to do it. The required amount, I want you to know, is insight. So don't think that your contribution will just go into somewhere that never gets anywhere, because it will. And when the book is published, probably not until a few years from now, but you will be able to say, I contributed to that undertaking. So write to me at carolyn@carolynyeager.com for Carlo's email address, which you need to send him, need in order to send him money through PayPal. And if you know of another way to send him money, we'll do it your way. But this way works pretty well. Now, Frederick, are you there?
I am here, Caroline.
Well, wonderful. And you know how important this book can be.
It's right? Extremely important that it's in fact the final chapter and the final nail into the Holocaust lie. The Einsatzgruppen is the final frontier, and it needs to be brought out. And who better to do it than Carlo Matonio in Italy and Jürgen Graf in Moscow?
Right. And also Thomas Kues.
And of course, yes.
In Sweden.
Yes.
So we have our international group of people.
An international commission.
yes. There you are.
Yep.
And we're lucky to have them. And I was thinking the other night that I don't know of any young revisionists coming up, younger revisionists coming up, I should say, who have these kind of skills. These men know several languages, especially Jürgen, who's amazing in language, and they are scholarly and they are capable. And so many of our revisionist scholars have been sort of put out of commission or they've quit writing. And so I don't know of any younger ones coming up. And so that's why I think it's very important that we make use of these wonderful men and their skills while they are still available, right?
Yeah, and if you think Jürgen Graf speaks 17 languages and mm-hmm. therefore he can go to the primary sources and he can translate them, this is why the people who don't want the Holocaust information to get through have to rely on this heavy-handed instrument. It's a blunt one. It's the legal instrument to silence these people. Jürgen's been in exile for over a decade. And
yes.
All because he refuses to believe in the Holocaust and says we have to look at it and get the details. And once, we demolished the nonsense about Auschwitz having been a gas chamber site and millions of people having been guests there, the official narrative moved eastwards, and the Einsatzgruppe is the final chapter in the Holocaust story, where the problems will be clarified, I hope, and that's still the point. The question is, you know, what happened to the Jews when they went eastward? That will be illuminated, I hope, at least in this book that the three of them are working on.
Yes, as soon as they can get access to actually being able to see it and read it. So, all right, thank you. I hope that encouraged people to help out with this, because the more people, the less it takes for each one. But I know that there are some more major donors, and I really appreciate them, and I hope they will let me know when they have made their contribution so that,
well,
I know,
you know
how much, you know.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Again, we then have to point out that the only real revisionist thrustings per book and journals is the Barnes Review. They're the only ones who are still focusing on these issues that still are not laid to rest, and most likely in many individuals will never come to rest, because it has developed into a mythology, into a folklore that then people simply hand down from generation to generation, and there'll always then be the few who actually know the truth.
Yes, and you know, I just finished another article with Wilhelm Mann on from the Giesler book that we've been translating, and we finished, but then we just added another one about Albert Speer, and it's just so wonderful to have the Barnes Review, because if it weren't for the Barnes Review, and as you said, what they're doing, they're the only ones doing anything for Holocaust literature. If it weren't for them, none of this kind of thing would be published anywhere. There is no other magazine that would publish the kinds of things that some of us write. And I'm going to have an article in this upcoming issue too, a different one. So I'll just give a little plug for that. You know, a lot of radio hosts, they spend a lot of time selling things and talking about their products and so on. And I do that very little, but sometimes I think I should do more of it. All right. Well, you know, this makes what you just said, Frederick, makes me think of 9/11. And because you were talking about, well, the hardening of the narrative and of the story that becomes so officialized that people won't even consider not accepting it just as it is. And we're, you know, if we don't make better headway with 9/11, that's what's happening now. They're getting with it, you know, they're getting that memorial built. And that will be a shrine to, you know, to believe in,
yeah,
the story. And there, and but, I think it's too bad that right now there's so much dissension and argumentativeness coming up.
Yeah, I was just thinking, though, you've just had, the East Coast has just had Irene sweeping through. And my good friend Amelia Remia in Raleigh reported that it was quite stormy, but it wasn't too bad. And yet we hear reports about New York closing down, or the mayor just, you know, for security reasons to close it down and overcome that possible disaster that may be upon them in that period. But nothing really happened. Certainly dangers or people were killed and the usual catastrophes occurred. But then if we link that kind of natural catastrophe with the man-made one, the 9/11 one, then we see that we are dealing with a natural catastrophe with the Irene and this man-made one, 9/11, and how the man-made one, as you indicated, is going to be propped up by having monuments built, by not having documentation released that is fundamental. For example, the video clips in the Pentagon area. Therefore, I always, when I look at these disasters, the natural disaster passes over, is looked at openly, while the others are closed down.
Well,
and that to me indicates there's something wrong.
Yes. Well, why doesn't it indicate to more people? I think right now there's a lot of discussion going on about disinformation being brought in more and more. Of course, it's always been there, but we didn't always see it because any information, any new information was so interesting in the beginning. Now it seems like we're overloaded with talk about how these explosions were done, say in New York, how the Pentagon was, what went into the Pentagon and so on. And they get very minute and very technical and exacting, and people can't follow them. And you've gotten in a little trouble the last couple of days, using that word trouble again for you, with some people saying that you are, spreading things around the internet that you shouldn't do because we should all get along and we should not be talking about what might be the problem here or the problem there. What would you say about that?
Well, trouble, life is trouble, only death is not. To be alive is to take off your belt and look for trouble. That's what Zorba said. And I sense that we reach a point in our life, and Caroline, you said you pointed this out, that there are individuals who are not doing anything anymore about it. They're getting tired, or they're not even interested in the issue anymore, because our capitalistic, free, and democratic Western society is exhausted. It is slipping into a coma. And you can see it again and again with issues being raised through the internet, but then being stifled and taken off the public agenda. If you look at the American, that's my impression at least, the basic public debate is really very, very superficial. It's one of liking, of not liking, of one of feeling guilty about something or not feeling guilty about something. It's not getting to the crux of things. And seeing we're on the 9/11 and the matter, let me just mention the issue that I was involved in with veterans today, Gordon Duff and Anthony Lawson. I sense that and I only found this out later, that Anthony Lawson wanted a certain item removed from Veterans Today on account of the author being a proven liar. Now, that is a serious accusation made by a serious scholar on 9/11. And I sense that has to be looked at. If you have someone, for example, in the revisionist movement saying, as we just had recently with Dr. Christian Lindner becoming initially not a non-believer in the gas chambers of Auschwitz, now becoming a believer.
Yeah,
now,
not at Auschwitz, but elsewhere.
And elsewhere.
Yeah, he decided, well, there were gassings in Treblinka or in the East. He did change, yes.
Yeah, but the fact is that, in other words, he's now a believer in the extermination theory.
Yes.
And the Holocaust rests on the three pillars: the 6 million, the systematic state extermination order, and the murder weapon, the homicidal gas chambers. Those three pillars. Anyone who does not believe in those three pillars is a revisionist, is a skeptic, is someone who has done hard work and has not found the evidence. But those who then suddenly say, like Lindner, there were gassings, limited gassings in Treblinka and elsewhere, well, they, and I come back to this, they are either ignorant of the physical facts, they are liars, or they are both. because anyone who has looked at the material, and then I go back to Gemma Rudolph, Arthur Butz, and Forrest, and then all the heavies who have written the books, who have made a study of the assertions made by the Holocaust believers, then you find that there are liars. And not only just liars, you reach that sophistry with that fellow. Remember that clip of that fellow who said his wife threw an apple to him every day.
Oh, and yes, Rosen something.
Yeah, Rosenstein or Zweig or whatever. But where he then said, when the interviewer said, but that's a lie, he said, no, it wasn't a lie. In my mind, it was true.
Oh, that's great to bring that up. That's a great example.
Yeah, that's the point. This is why, if you go you're aware of these things, when then somebody says, oh, but in my mind, it's true. And I think Anthony Lawson stumbled on that as well with the 9/11 issue. That's not good enough.
Right. That is what Jim Fetzer has started saying. That he said it quite a while back. That he starts going into an argument about what is a lie rather than defending his position very well. And he says, it's not a lie if I didn't intend to lie and if I believe in it. And this is the issue.
And this is why I say the Holocaust believers, we cannot call them liars, because it's their belief. But if they say it's a physical fact that it happened, as soon as they say it happened physically, then we can get them and say, well, provide the proof. And they can't, of course. Can never be done. And they'll talk their way out of all sorts of ways. By saying, oh, the evidence has been removed, the Germans, on the, you know, the usual thing, on the one hand,
yes,
the Germans.
Yes, well, I think that the 9/11 people who are arguing back and forth have a lot more leeway to do some things than the Holocaust people do, because they are discussing all these various ways in which the buildings could have exploded and might have exploded, and a lot of it is totally unknown. It's just theoretical, and they talk and talk and talk. Well, some people seem to want them to do that. They seem to think that's important, where others, and I would be in that camp, say, look, we know that the official story cannot have happened, as they say. We know enough things. We know so many things we can bring up. We don't have to argue about exactly what type of explosive or non-explosive or no planes theory or planes theory or directed energy weapons or this and that. We don't need to argue about things like that.
Exactly.
People rightly say that that's up to the courts and that's up to those to decide after we get into a proper investigation. But these people, I think, therefore, and Jim Fetzer is one of them, he's probably the most important one, who keep pushing all this talk and writes article after article. And the issue is that with Anthony Lawson is that Veterans Today is hosting those articles now, and just in the time for the 10th anniversary. And they are then accusing him of being a problem at the 10th anniversary because he's trying to bring up squabbles that they think he should be quiet about. And this is all,
if I say this, this kind of, it's not squabbling, it's not causing trouble. It is a normal individual's right, I would say, if we talk about rights, to continue on the line. Anthony Lawson has been consistent, and he has realized that Fetzer is diverting the energy and the attention onto irrelevant matters. It doesn't matter. We've got to get the more fundamental issues. This is why we have individuals in revisionism for whom the heat is too great, and they want to then compromise and go along the Fetzer line and get into the little nitty gritty of things, and deviate from the fundamental. And in the Holocaust thing, it's the three pillars. And then the ones who continue on it, like Lawson in 9/11, they then tried to sideline them by being troublemakers. Mm-hmm. I don't go in for this kind of business where, you know, where people say, oh, look, he's causing trouble. and I agree with you on that. I mean, it's marvelous for me to have read the email exchange you've had with Ingrid Rimland on this matter. And, you know, it's interesting how the Holocaust revisionists are so much more mature in looking at 9/11 because the structures are the same. We're looking at deceptive structures, and we're looking at, in real life, how the deceptive structure is solidified into the social fabric.
Very good. Yes, because, you know, I've been saying for a while now that 9/11 people should recognize that the Holocaust truth movement has the same problems that they have, and they don't want anything to do with the Holocaust. They want to defend Holocaustism, but they want people to join them in exposing the untruth of the 9/11 official theory. So where do you think disinformation comes in here? This is my concern, that these are not honest arguments necessarily.
Yeah. There are vested interests who cannot let the Holocaust go for a while yet. We have to look at those structures. Same with 9/11 or even the latest Norwegian episode. We have to look at the structures that... The old cui bono, in whose interest is it for this event to have occurred? And then you can see the ones that are defending it, then there's certain people watering it down. We had the same thing in Australia with the Port Arthur massacre. The pattern of narrative development is very similar to what the Norwegians did, or even the Tucson, Arizona one that never got off the ground. For me, that's a very interesting one, how initially that was really going to galvanize the American people. Even the president, Barack Obama, came to Tucson to give his eulogy and to celebrate the people who survived and the ones who assisted and so on. The old thing. Then, when somebody comes in 9/11 case, like Anthony and so on, who says, hey, wait a minute, let's look at these items again, they are seen as troublemakers, and so they counter that by bringing in victims who speak on behalf of their own grief and whatever, which cannot but succeed in raising the emotional intensity of the event, thereby switching off critical thinking. And this gets me, this trotting out the victims or those who've lost people in these tragedies mm-hmm. with their stories of suffering, as if that is then to prove the overarching conspiracy, saying that a bunch of terrorists did it. That mechanism has to be exposed, and once you realize and see it, it's the same pattern.
Well, that's it. When you see it, you know, I don't know what keeps people from. Let me just say this: that we know that disinformation is a tactic that has been used for a long, long time. There's no time when it wasn't, even though it wasn't called that or so sophisticated. But there is no way to think that it has not been seeded throughout all of these movements. It's not been seeded throughout the 9/11 movement. And yet then you have people, I guess, accusing one another, and then it does get kind of messy. And I don't know. I lost interest because they're just arguing about highly technical things that I can't really follow.
Yeah, but Caroline, this is the interesting thing, that once they get into that nitty-gritty thing, you can justify anything, and that's where we have to then throw away the written word and rely on our intuition, on our basic instincts again. And philosophically, there's a whole movement, it's phenomenology, where you simply look at the world and with your senses, your five senses, and not just the words, you perceive what's going on out there. Our body is good enough to give us enough information with which we can utilize the world or make sense of the world and survive in it. Now, once you reach that point again, reason and the written word becomes irrelevant. If you look at, for example, the 9/11, if you contrast that,
we've only got about 10 seconds before the break starts, Frederick.
Okay.
Well, now we've got five.
All right. We'll see
if
you in
I'm
a,
right.
in a
We'll hear so, soon. We're going to hear this music coming up.
Right.
Well, it hasn't started yet. I just didn't want you to be cut off. But then I end up cutting you off. So what happened to the...
I can hear it. Bye.
All right. Well, ladies and gentlemen, we'll be right back after this news break.
We'll be right back with more on The Heretics Hour. You're listening to VOR, ReasonRadioNetwork.com.
All right, back to the United States. I mentioned money, but what about money in the U.S.? Where is the U.S. economy headed, and what are U.S. leaders doing about it? Well, if you look at the numbers, it looks like the economy is certainly not going up. Out today, numbers show that the U.S. economy barely is growing. It grew just 0.2%, barely any, in the second quarter of 2011. This is down from what was first estimated. And the economy for the year, if you draw those numbers out, it's supposed to grow 1% this year. That's down from first estimates of 1.3%. So this all adds to a list of facts, worse than expected news, that have economists such as Nouriel Roubini saying we're headed into a recession. It's what has some economists who come on this show saying we're already in one. Now, these growth numbers out today, they're the kind of news that would put pressure on the Federal Reserve or the U.S. government to do more. But lo and behold, in Ben Bernanke's highly anticipated speech this morning in Jackson Hole, he actually didn't announce more quantitative easing. Many analysts were looking for that. Here's what he did say at Jackson Hole. He said the Federal Reserve does have a range of tools that could be used to provide additional monetary stimulus. We will continue to consider those and other pertinent issues, including, of course, economic and financial developments, at our meeting in September, which has been scheduled for 2 days instead of one to allow for a fuller discussion. So he kind of postponed any kind of action. But is this really a good or a bad thing? And more alarming, too, perhaps, are Bernanke's positive economic assessments. He said in his speech, for example, financial markets and institutions have already made considerable progress toward normalization. Meanwhile, we have seen Bank of America's stock tanking and getting a $5 billion investment from Warren Buffett to assure people that they're staying afloat. Is this a sign of what's to come? To answer all of these questions, not answered in Bernanke's speech, I spoke with Carl Denninger of the Market Ticker. I asked him first if it's a good or a bad thing that Bernanke is not announcing more quantitative easing right now. Here's what he said.
Well, quantitative easing, too, didn't work. Objectively, the only thing it did was lift stock prices, and now all of the increase that we got over the space of 8 months came off in about 3 weeks. So all we ended up with is a temporary sugar high in the stock market and higher gasoline prices. Well, higher gas prices are bad from a consumer point of view, not good. So I don't see why the market would be looking for him to do more of what hasn't worked or why he would engage in more of what hasn't worked. It doesn't make any sense.
Well, who benefits from that? Because there are a lot of people that are saying that it's what's needed and that when it does come, it'll be too little too late. What's the benefit of that?
There really isn't one, and that's the problem, is that you add things to the balance sheet. You basically make the Federal Reserve balance sheet larger.
Let's return to the Heretics Hour, brought to you by VOR, ReasonRadioNetwork.com. And now here's Carolyn.
Welcome back, ladies and gentlemen. And I'm here with Frederick Tobin of Australia, my guest. And Frederick, I wanted to ask you about your YouTube account, which I have learned from you, or it was just taken down, and I'm not clear what it was that triggered them to take your entire account down. Is that correct?
Yes. On the 27th of August, I sent an item through the email list titled YouTube Video Notification, End of the Line for Tobin's Fiddle with YouTube. I received a notification. It said, regarding your account, Frederick Tobin, the YouTube community has flagged one or more of your videos as inappropriate. Once a video is flagged, it is reviewed by the YouTube team against our community guidelines. Upon review, we have determined that the following video contains content in violation of these guidelines and have been disabled. And the title I gave this clip was Talmudic-inspired political action leads to Holocaust in communist countries. And it then went on, because this is the third violation of the community guidelines in 6 months, you have received previous warnings. Your account has now been terminated. Please be aware that you are prohibited from accessing, possessing, or creating any other YouTube accounts. For more information on YouTube's community guidelines and how they are enforced, please visit the Help Center and so on. Sincerely, the YouTube team.
Now, don't you hate being talked to and treated like a child, like a kindergartner, by people like that?
Well, it for me, it reflects more on them. I see this as a victory. They had to silence me. They had to pull the plug on me without giving me a right of reply, basic natural justice. And that's typical because YouTube has Jewish interests that are out simply trying to stifle any criticism of the state of Israel, what it does to Palestine, and any other Jewish matters. For example, the clip, the final clip that tipped it, was essentially one taken from YouTube. All three clips that they objected to, I obtained on YouTube. And now this one is still doing the rounds on YouTube.
The word Talmudic in it.
The second clip they objected to was the Norwegian thing. I downloaded that and put it up, and so they pulled it. That was my second offense. Now this thing is the third offense, and it essentially the clip is a nice compilation. For example, it begins with the words, between the years 1917 and 91, preceding the collapse of the Soviet Union, it is estimated that these communist Jews murdered somewhere between 60 and 135 million innocent people. And of course, this is a fact. It cannot be, it can be discussed away, but the fact, the physical facts are there that it was a Jewish mindset that went for the non-Jews in Russia, Talmudic, in fact. And therefore, just like the Katyn massacre, all these things come out in time, and individuals want to point out that, oh, no, it wasn't really Jewish. Yes, it was. There were Jews at the helm. It's just as if a crime is committed, one would say, well, that an American did it, or a German did it. There's nothing wrong with that. Nobody has a monopoly on a criminal mindset. But
what's wrong is there's nothing wrong with saying who is responsible for things. This idea, yes, that people don't have to be responsible, that they are somehow freed from all responsibility, and you better not say anything about what they did.
Of course, the big no-no in Jewish matters is looking at Talmud and how that divides the world into a death dialectic of them, us, Jews and non-Jews. And that's still being enforced in Palestine. Mm-hmm. So anyway, I wrote an email through about this, and from there on it developed, because I said, it's finally happened. Note the offending topic. We live in interesting times, and I can now relax and stop exciting those who fear the truth, the immature, the liars and slaves who have no home within their own minds because their worldview is built on a lie. Hence their frenzied and irrational, feverish mind going in overdrive in order to control free thinkers by any means. I sense Anthony Lawson may be the next because he's getting too close to the truth in matters 9/11 and other such insider jobs that benefit the racist Zionist state of Israel, among others. I add a point. Did you notice the matter about that terrible Nigerian bombing and how this is aimed to divide Nigeria into southern Christian and northern Muslim mm-hmm. states? Mm-hmm. And guess what political power has become active in resource-rich Nigeria? Well, a few months ago, Israel signed not a peace treaty, but a security treaty with Nigeria. And now, just the other day, an item came through that Israeli and Austrian investors explore opportunities. They gathered in Lagos to explore the opportunities in Nigeria's energy and agricultural sector. At the instance of the International Strategic Alliance Committee, a group of Nigerian professionals and diaspora. You see, then if you do some research and find out when Israel and Nigeria signed a security pact, then you know what's going on. And we mm-hmm. had the evidence in Libya just recently where the rebels, the alleged rebels or so-called rebels, are going to recognize Israel. So the legitimate activity of Israel securing its own existence is up afoot. It's in the open. People can see this. And the trouble is there are those who disagree with such an activity. And one of them is Iran. And we see the problems in
understandably
Syria.
So, since they want to destroy Iran.
Yeah. So you can see how important the Holocaust mythology is, because that is the backbone of the state of Israel. But there is comfort. Most non-Semitic Jews who came to Israel before, during, and after the Second World War, many of their descendants have gone back to Germany and to other parts in America, Australia, New Zealand, and South Africa. And many of them are coming to Western Australia. Western Australia is now a great haven. It's going to be a terribly rich area. There's even talk of Western Australia seceding from the Commonwealth of Australia because of the mineral wealth. And there are.
Well, why is this a comfort?
Well, it's a comfort for those who are going to leave Israel and finally let the normal thing happen, that of establishing one state of Palestine.
Well, fine, but we don't want them, do we?
Well, and this is where I have to become diplomatic and say, as I've always said, when we talk about the Jewish issue, don't blame the Jews, blame those that bend
well,
to their
you're
pressure.
Not, yeah, but when you have people so skilled at manipulation, constantly manipulating, in control of all the media, Frederick, you can't really say, well, people should not bend because they don't, there's, the power is too great. Now, well, let's go to this Occidental Observer you sent to me. And now, what is the answer to this, to these problems?
Well, this is what the Occidental Observer, I think your listeners are aware of what material it pushes out. Kevin McDonald's mm-hmm. done a marvelous job by posting articles that really get to the heart of an issue. This one, Matt Johnson,
That's right. He's the author.
He's the author of the article, and he's also written a book, Political Theory of Vladimir Putin, and that was published by the Barnes Review Press. Now,
Alexander Lukashenko has developed something called social nationalism.
Yeah, well, social nationalism, isn't that national socialism? What's the difference?
Well, essentially
what he's done is disconnected from the international system, and he has developed a nationalist ethos very much on the line of Hitler's national socialism, where you do not rely on the International Monetary Fund or the World Bank or any other external organizations, where you rely on your inner resources, where the principle of autarky, of self-sufficiency, is uppermost. This means you don't have to import labor, for example, as all in the Western world have to do, because in our Western model, we have essentially the super rich and the super poor, and the in between are being squeezed out, the so-called stifling middle class mm-hmm. with its morality but stability. They are on the way out.
But this Belarus is a tiny country, Frederick. I think, what did I read? How many million people does it have? Not very many. It's the size of one of our states here in the United States. Not a very big one either. I can't find out how big it is. But how much influence do they have? I mean, they're being allowed. He's doing well now, I guess, with this. But he's very small. He's not like Germany was in the 1930s.
Yeah, but I hear what you're saying, that they're permitting him to continue to live. Russia is, in some respects, protecting him. The international monetary thrustings could, if they didn't have that protection, demolish him.
That's right.
The predatory capitalism, like they demolished Libya, which had a similar model. Libya was a similar nationalist state, and they decided to get rid of it because they need the resources. And, they've already got the money printed in for the Libyan new economy and all that stuff. So it'll be totally linked. While before that, like Belarus, they didn't have any debt. And we're full of debt.
Yes. Well, now he's, so Russia is allowing him to do this because Russia wants to keep Belarus on their side. And I think, the EU and the United States and so on wants to bring Belarus into the Western, alliances, right?
Yeah.
So Russia is helping them. And, but, you know, I wonder how much influence, this can have. It's interesting though that he calls it, social nationalism. And the problem with the Russian government is that they are very adamant about keeping their history, the way they have it. And, that's a problem.
Yeah. I'm just picking out one sentence of this article where it says, okay, the entire point of law is to protect labor from the arrogance and currency fetishism of the ruling class. Only strong leadership able to go over the heads of the powerful can fashion such laws. Lukashenko and Belarus have reaped the benefits of such a policy. In other words, you know, in confronting with the onslaught of Western democracy and freedom under that guise of this predatory capitalism ripping the guts out of, as it did initially out of Russia and then out of Ukraine. This didn't happen in Belarus. Let me just read. He translated this where Lukashenko in 2006 in State of the Union address said, the country's development policy line worked out by us has proved right. High rates of economic growth, which our economy has been already demonstrating for more than 10 years, provide good evidence thereof. Just compare. Our annual GDP growth over the past five-year planning period was 7.5% as against 3.5% of the world average. Western theoreticians fail to explain the reasons of such a success. They do not fit in with their democratic scheme. The reasons, however, are simple. We have not embezzled the people's wealth. We have not got into burdensome debts, relying on life itself. We have worked out our own model of development based on well-balanced and thought-out reforms. Without any sweeping privatization and shock therapy, preserving everything that was best in our economy and in our traditions.
Well, that's the way it should be done, of course.
Yeah. At the same time, he says, we have been learning to work under new market conditions, taking advantage of the experience elsewhere in the world and taking into account the modern trends of the world economy. Strong state power, strong social policy, and reliance on the people. That is what explains the secret behind our success. And, of course, liberal democracy in the West is doing the opposite. It's knocking the people out. It's sedating them. What is it? The sex, drugs, and rock and roll and all that stuff.
Mm-hmm.
The young are not gearing towards anything anymore. There are pockets, of course, and certain industries, high-tech industries, that are doing well. But if you look at the social fabric, if you walk around a city, you can soon tell. I mean, if you think that in Singapore, if you don't flush the toilet, you receive a fine. Now, if you go to other countries and you look at their sanitary conditions, this is where we have to start.
Well, that's not freedom. That's not freedom.
Exactly.
You know,
the freedom.
If you should be free not to flush the toilet if you don't want to.
Yeah,
you
the know, freedom
that, that's
to...
the problem. That's the problem we have with freedom. Freedom has become something that's not what it should be. You know,
The freedom to self-destruct.
Yes. Yes. Well, you think that Belarus can have any influence on its surrounding smaller nations?
Oh, I think automatically, as soon as this model makes history, it emerges as what it says it is, there'll be individuals who'll go and try to undermine it. We had this in Malaysia. Remember, Malaysia stood firm against George Soros's economic monetary onslaught, and what happened? Massive pressure on the Malaysians, And,
well, that's what I was going to say, because just in the EU, they will punish any nation, if you can still call them nations, that starts voting right wing. You know, if any right wing party start getting stronger, as is happening, say, in Austria. Well, the last time that happened, they absolutely punished Austria economically terribly, and the Austrians are very afraid of that. And there you are, you see. And then they have too much power, and they do not let anybody succeed in these ways. If Belarus is doing it, it's because of Russia, and because maybe they're not that important yet.
Yes, but, you know, I know that if somebody gets too important, they have accidents, like Jörg Haider with the right-wing movement, but in time you also, and this is only a hopeful thing, you know that within the groups that are trying to sustain their imperial boundaries, there is also a breakdown. And that is then following a natural law, I think, that you have that breakdown from within. If we look at world politics, some would say, well, we're waiting for America to collapse in order for other nations to be free.
Well, do you think that will happen? I mean, do you think, I mean, it seems to me that breakdowns often bring about the most powerful elements can get control. And we know who the most powerful elements are. So I don't know how anybody else is going to get control. Yeah. And they're so sophisticated in their understanding of human psychology. Now, I was thinking about that today, the human nature, it comes down to some very basic things that we all care about most. You know, like one is belonging. People really, the people need to belong to something, and so people will belong to whatever is available, and they use that to manipulate people. And nobody wants to be kicked out in the cold, you know. Nobody wants to be rejected by their peers or by the rest of the group and so on. These things are so basic and so easy to manipulate people through these human characteristics that we all have.
Yeah, I know. There comes a point where maturity kicks in. And
I hope. You talk about that a lot, and I know you believe in it. Let me just say this. Say a site like Veterans Today, I think that plays a lot on popularity and on the idea that this is the end thing, and that people, there's a whole masses of people who feel like that's kind of like home for them, you know, and they belong there, and they like that sense of belonging, and they'll talk to other writers like they're their friends, you know, buddies and so on, and they've never met them. We fall for all this stuff. I think a lot of these sites are for this very purpose.
Well, that's for some, they comfort. There is comfort offered, but in the long run, as I've always maintained, in the long run, the comfort comes from having that home within your own mind, and then you can focus on the more fundamental issues. And in clarifying the truth of a matter, and like any social fabric, if it's built on lies, it will break down. Like the engineer who tells lies about when he plans the bridge, and then the bridge is constructed, and he's fiddled the books, and it'll break. It'll collapse. And so, same thing with the theoretical overarching framework that makes up our society. The ideology, it will break down in time. It must. Truth will always out, even if it's 100 years hence. This is why I shy away from developing this notion that I must see the end of the Holocaust lie. I want to be there when it crashes. That's almost a kind of hubris kicking in. You want to rejoice at the other person's misfortune of the other person having believed in a lie, and you want to see his downfall. I don't go that
well,
far.
Well, I don't think it's necessarily that. It could, you know, some cases things are that way. But I wouldn't put that. I think, though, that because I would like to see it, but and maybe that is there. But, you know, you take so much abuse and you get pretty tired of it. But I think this is a good point to end. We are coming to the end, and I think it's right. Very good what you're saying about finding your home in your own mind. And I think we need to strengthen in that so much so that we're not prey to all of this, all of these sophisticated methods of disability.
And that means you have to start thinking fearlessly. Yeah.
Yes, and you were talking before about thinking and not feeling. You want to say any more about that?
No, I do both. You have to do both because the non-thinking person is pre-thinking. It's not non-thinking. We're thinking all the time. The mind is active all the time. But there are people who perceive things, who see a phenomenon and they see the pattern and they as yet haven't had words, can't find words for it. Unlike Wittgenstein and all these language philosophers who went on the wrong trail and tried to disconnect people from actual thinking, when you see these things and you can't quite find the words, keep at it. In time, it will emerge. Things will emerge and you will see and understand, even if you can't find the words for it yet. You know whether something is true. You know whether somebody's telling a lie. Just watch somebody's body language. Mm-hmm. All these nonverbal things give us an indication if something is true or not.
Yes, and I think that when you want to know something, if you consciously make it clear to yourself that you want to understand something or you want to know who's right, who's wrong, whatever, in a dispute, give it a little time and it will come to you.
Yes,
I really do believe that.
Yes, and then be careful, be cautious and diplomatic. And so on, but
all right.
Keep at it.
And thank you so much, Frederick Tobin, for being on the Heritage Hour tonight. Good night to you.
Good night.
Good night, listeners, and come back next week.
Thanks for listening. The Heretics Hour returns Monday evening, 9 p.m. Eastern U.S. time. Join us at ReasonRadioNetwork.com.